Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 4 months ago, corruption charges were filed against a former Fiat Chrysler labor executive and the wife of the late UAW Vice President General Holyfield. They're accused of funneling millions intended for training UAW workers into their own pockets. Well, today's Detroit News has an exclusive report that federal agents have broadened this corruption investigation to include a member of the General Motors Board and the head of the UAW's GM department, and that the feds are looking into the UAW training centers funded by GM and Ford. The reporting team on this story is Robert Snell, Ian Thibodeau, and Daniel Howes, who is with us now. Daniel, you and I talked about those indictments against FCA's labor negotiator Al Iacobelli and the widow of the late General Holyfield. Remind us again what they're accused of.
Basically, it was a $4.5 million scheme to enrich themselves, the most prominent of which is, a $37,000 Mont Blanc pen or two, maybe. Monica Holyfield got her mortgage paid off, some $260,000 mortgage. Al Iacobelli landscaped his home, had an outdoor kitchen. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on and on. But now I think what's happened is the grand jury and the federal investigators are starting to look at the other training centers in Detroit to see if some of these patterns are repeated elsewhere. They don't just issue subpoenas on a whim. There's got to be some, as I understand it, this is not my expertise, it's really Rob Snell's expertise, but as I understand this, as he's educated me, they have to have some kind, they present evidence to a grand jury to say this is why we need to issue these subpoenas. They don't just do them as a matter of course.
And remind us, again, these joint training sessions, what are they for and who funds them?
Each auto company in Detroit has one. They're an outgrowth of some federal legislation, as I recall, in the late 70s, early 80s. If you think back to that time, that's when the industry had kind of imploded. A lot of people were losing their jobs. Now, obviously, they came back, but one of the things that they created were centers to train workers who might have lost their jobs or to train those who remain to be better at their jobs, to make American manufacturing more competitive. It's important for people to understand this is the money that funds these training centers is not the dues money that members pay to the union. It is money that is earmarked by the corporations, usually during negotiations, and they have a set amount of money that they commit to putting into the training centers. The training centers are managed independently. They are independent corporate entities from the corporations themselves. They are not an arm of the corporation. They're not an arm of the union. But typically, as I understand it, most of the staffing inside the training centers comes from the union side, not from the corporate side.
Who's being looked at in this expanded probe?
Well, insofar as we've been able to tell, they're interested in looking at Joe Ashton, who was between 2010 and 2014 the VP in charge of the GM UAW department, essentially the top guy with General Motors for the union. And then he was succeeded in 2014 by Cindy Estrada, the first Latina woman to ever head a department, and if I'm not mistaken, to ever head one of the big three departments. There have been women in the executive committee before, but not in that very critical job.
And Joe Ashton then went to the GM board?
He did. Coming out of the bankruptcy, the UAW ended up owning a pretty large chunk of General Motors stock.
I remember that.
At one point, it was 7%, 8%. We checked the numbers in the most recent filings, pegged that number at 9.3%. So I believe they are the largest shareholder in the company, almost to 10%. He represents effectively, it's the retiree trust that looks after the retiree health care obligations that GM once funded on its own, but then ultimately was able to cut a deal and create this VEBA that then pays those benefits for retirees, hundreds of thousands of retirees around the country.
And your story also looks at that questions seem to be raised about charities that each of the UAW presidents heads up. Talk us about that.
Yeah, I think one of the things that they're interested in is whether the charities, each of these vice presidents typically, you can't say categorically, but typically these vice presidents at these three departments have a charity that they create, or they have a favorite charity, but a lot of them create their own. And they may be on the board of the charity. And if you look at the 990s of these charities, you will typically see them named. Joe Ashton, as I recall, is the treasurer of his own charity. These don't have huge amounts of money in them. They're not tens or hundreds of millions of dollars by any means. They may be around $1 million, a little bit more, a little bit less. But the question is whether those charities are being used in some way to enrich other members of the union or other officers or themselves.
In your story, Daniel, you quote the federal indictment as saying Iacobelli and other UAW Chrysler Training Center officials created, and I'm going to quote here, a liberal spending policy to keep senior UAW leaders fat, dumb, and happy.
Yeah, that came out of the indictment, as you mm-hmm. suggest, and I think that one of the things the government ultimately is arguing here, or trying to prove, is that the way the money may have moved around here may have corrupted the bargaining process. They were essentially trying to buy results, I've talked to people who have been involved in these negotiations for a very long time, and they're very skeptical of that. But clearly the government is trying to connect the dots to be able to prove that. Whether they're able to do that, I think, remains to be seen.
And you spoke with Wayne State University law professor and former federal prosecutor Peter Henning, who's often a guest here on this show. Mm-hmm. What points did he raise about this Wyden probe and what this could mean?
I think he thinks that they're looking at how they're being enriched. I mean, he clearly thinks that's an issue. The other thing he thinks is an issue is General Motors coming out of the exploding airbag, the ignition switch airbag fiasco, was under a deferred prosecution agreement with the government that basically said they are under federal monitoring for about 3 years. And it basically saying, you got to keep your nose clean. And so the question, if there are any kind of charges here, whether that would implicate General Motors and get them afoul of the feds. Obviously, General Motors is saying, listen, we will work with anybody. We are open to this investigation. We will cooperate. And they're going to bend over backwards. And he makes the point that they'll do whatever they have to do to make sure they don't get afoul of this. Another thing I think is very important to note is, so far, these subpoenas are not targeted at the car companies. They are targeted at the training centers. As I said, they're independent. These are separate corporate entities. The corporations were notified that their training centers had received these subpoenas. But General Motors and Ford Motor Company, in this case, as corporate entities, have not received these subpoenas. They are not subpoenaed.
So, Daniel, if these federal charges against the FCA executive and General Holyfield's widow, Monica Morgan Holyfield, wind up in convictions, what could that portend for the future of the UAW?
Well, I think you could make the argument that this is a real institutional body blow to the union. There's been a narrative out there on the shop floor, and certainly not by everybody, but it's out there, that the internet, what they call the international leaders at the international, i.e. in Detroit, mm-hmm. are basically playing a high-stakes game with dues money, and they're out to enrich themselves. And they're not out to actually look out for the interests of the members. This, I think, clearly will underscore that narrative, kind of irrespective of what happens. I mean, I think most people who watch this probably assume that the Iacobelli and Holyfield charges will end up in convictions. I mean, obviously, it has to play out. Now, whether there are other charges that come from this, I think, remains to be seen. But if there are, I think that's very difficult for the union. You know, you cut back a couple of months, there was an organizing vote down in Canton, Mississippi at Nissan, and it lost, and the union thought they were going to have it, and these charges exploded within, I don't know, weeks of the vote. Needless to say, that probably didn't help with the folks down there in Mississippi. And I think if you could expand this, it's going to be difficult.
Indeed, Peter Henning says in your story it could rile up members and lead to an insurgency.
Exactly right.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howe is part of a reporting team with an exclusive story. FBI's UAW Training Center probe widens to GM and Ford. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
He was one of the most beloved of Detroit's pro athletes when he was with Detroit. Now Justin Verlander is going to be sporting a World Series ring thanks to that trade a couple months ago that sent him to the Houston Astros, who beat LA in Game 7 last night to win the series. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon is here now. Well, Houston Astros are the World Series champs, and you said it would need to go to Game 7 to become a series for the ages.
And it just about is. Now, there's some blowouts along the way, so it was not all, well, there weren't all great games, but this one is one of the classics. And also, by the way, the playoffs, the final four teams happen to be the four most populous U.S. cities out there, New York, Chicago, Houston, L.A., and God bless the Astros. The town does not solve all their problems, but what the heck?
Hurt. You got to stop and think. It was only 5 years ago that Justin Verlander was popping champagne corks in the Tiger locker room when they made it to the World Series 2012 against San Francisco, but swept in four. And if he hadn't have accepted that trade in those final moments back in August, going to Houston, he wouldn't be hoisting that trophy now.
Not his entire career, because Detroit's not going to win one in the next 3 or 4 years. There's no way. Mm-hmm. So good for him. And the reaction on Twitter for Verlander from the Detroit fans has been 100% positive.
Now, he really earned that goodwill, didn't he?
He sure did. Look, he pitched his heart out for many years in Detroit, never, ever gave a half-hearted effort, never complained about the rotten bullpen, never complained about the occasional spotty hitting, and never complained about being traded either. So this guy deserves it.
We also should give props to former Tiger Cameron Maben, also a Houston Astro. He sent a great picture of the two of them hugging each other, saying, "We're not in Detroit anymore. We're World Series champs."
Somehow we got this, right?
Now, and by the way, reports are popping up. JV's going to get two rings.
Apparently, he's going to be missing the team parade in Houston to go to Italy to marry Kate Upton. So that's one heck of a fall. Two large rings in one fall. Well done, sir.
Justin Verlander having his best life. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Coming up, TV rules our world, and now it could rule outer space.
It's a very simple way of creating a tiny community. There's not much cause for conflict with that kind of stuff. And you don't need to move. I mean, you can do it when you're scooped up in a little tin can.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Opportunities.
Part of the community.
The next idea.
A culture for innovation is a culture with a sense of destiny, a sense of that tomorrow's going to be better than today. That's what the word progress means.
The keys to a successful future for Michigan include turning out graduates with the skill sets to fill the jobs of the future and increasing access to post-secondary education for low-income, first-generation, and underrepresented students. The upcoming Michigan Pre-College and Youth Outreach Conference will explore these challenges, focusing on the urgency of college access. The keynote speaker at this 10th annual conference is Jamie Kassab. He's the global education evangelist for Google, and Jamie is with us. Now, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you for having me.
What is an education evangelist?
So I've been at Google for 12 years, and the entire time I've been at Google, I've been talking about education and the role that technology plays in education. So an evangelist is someone who brings good news, and I think that there are some really good news in the future of education and how technology can play a role in that.
And when we know that this conference that you're going to be keynoting is focusing on the urgency of college access, I know you were one of those low-income first-generation kids who used education, and you got out and moved up. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is where my passion for education comes from, is because I believe that education is what disrupts poverty. I believe that education can change a family's destiny in just one generation, and I'm living proof of that. And there's millions of people who are like me who can also prove that. I was born and raised in Hell's Kitchen, New York, and not the Hell's Kitchen that you find today with all the great restaurants, but the one from the 70s and 80s where it wasn't a nice place to grow up. And I saw the common denominator of people who were successful being education. So I focused on doing my schoolwork and graduating from high school and going to college and going to graduate school. And I'm doing today what I'm doing because of education, right? That's the power that education has. You can do this in one generation. But more importantly, my kids are okay, right? So I have three kids, and my daughter's 25 years old, and she's living in New York City right now working at her dream job. And it's because of my fourth grade teacher, my ninth grade teacher. And so that's the real power that we have with education, is that we can change families' lives in just one generation.
And we stop and realize you're the son of a single mother who was an immigrant.
Yeah, so my mother came from Argentina, escaping poverty and government oppression in the late 60s, and I was born and raised in New York, and, you know, I grew up on welfare and food stamps like many people did back then. And I saw lots of people struggle through that. And so I think that given the opportunity to get a good education is the most critical thing that we can give, especially for immigrants who are coming to this country.
And how can technology, Jamie, help to reach those students, bring them in the fold, as it were, and help them to that post-secondary education that changed your life?
Yeah, so at the core of this is the ability to access information, right? So when I was growing up and living in Hell's Kitchen and I had to do a book report, I had to go to the Columbus Library on 51st Street and 10th Avenue. That's where my information was. That's where all my resources were. And it closed at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and basketball practice went to 4:45. It wasn't open on the weekends. And if I could find that book through that card catalog machine that we had where you can have to memorize a 17-digit number because everyone stole the little pencils, I had to go find that book, and there's a good chance that book wasn't there because it wasn't my library, right? It was everyone who lived in Hell's Kitchen, everyone who went to PS17 and PS51 and all the schools in the neighborhood. That is no longer true. I have 100 million Columbus libraries at my fingertips, and that changes everything. So this gives us an opportunity to really live up to this idea that information equals education. And if we have access to all the information, then we can really change education. And so that at the core is where I think technology can play a huge role in learning.
I know you've often said we need to really realize that the future of education is right now. And we also need to rethink the way we educate and stop asking kids, what do you want to be when you grow up? Why is that?
Yeah, so it's one of those, so I talk to students all the time. I actually teach, besides my role at Google, I teach 10th grade communication at the Phoenix Coding Academy in Phoenix, Arizona. And I talk to students on a constant basis, and I ask them all the same question. And kids, as young as fifth grade, will answer the question when I ask them, you know, do your parents or has anyone ever asked you what you want to be when you grow up? And every single hand goes up. Because that's what we're used to doing. We're used to asking kids what they want to be when they grow up without the realization that we don't know what the future holds, right? 60% of the jobs in the future don't exist today. We're constantly recreating new jobs. Automation, robotics, machine learning, cloud computing will be impacting all jobs. And so that question makes no sense anymore. So I want to ask students, what problem do you want to solve? What's the problem that spins in your head? And the more important question is, what do you need to learn to solve that problem? What are the knowledge, skills, and abilities that you need to solve that problem? And that gets us really close to the things that are critical that motivate all of us, right? Which is purpose, autonomy, and mastery, which Daniel Pink talks about in his book, Drive.
Yeah, and if that's spinning in your head and it enchants you and draws you, then you're not really working as you pursue that career path.
Right. And here's the thing. It's the process of problem solving. If you ask employers all over the world, what's the number one skill you want your employees to have? And overwhelmingly, the answer is problem-solving skills. And so how do we teach problem-solving skills? So even if a fifth grader or a ninth grader says, I want to solve the problem of making cars go faster, it's the process that they learn of problem-solving, right? No matter what the problem is, there is a methodology that you use to solve that problem, and that's what we need to focus on.
In thinking about the future of education and what it should be in Michigan to build a strong economy for this state and turn out the graduates who can help Michigan's companies grow, what are the questions that we should be asking?
First of all, I think what's happening in Michigan is fantastic. I've watched Michigan over the last 20 years, and it's very similar to what I grew up like in New York in terms of like, oh, this is, you know, the place is going into the dumps, and now there's this whole realization of new buildings and new businesses moving to Detroit and other places. So it's exciting to see because I went through the same thing in New York. New York was in the dumps, and then in the 90s and in the 2000s, it went up. So that's great. So now we need to continue that in all our states. And the most important thing that we could do, and you just mentioned this, is not think about the future of education as something that we have to plan for 20 years from now, but literally the future of education, the future classroom starts on Monday. And what we need to do in the education world is give teachers the space to experiment, to try different things, to really take advantage of what they know. Because I've worked in workforces across spectrums, right? So I've spent 7 years at Accenture, and I worked in electronics and high tech and finance and banking and credit cards. I worked in government for 2 years, and there is no more passionate and dedicated group of a workforce than teachers. And so if we can give them the opportunity to show us what they can do, I think we'll see amazing things.
And this tool of technology, how should we be using that tool in the classrooms of the future?
Yeah, so let's start with this idea that it's not just about putting technology into our school systems. It's not just about putting machines into our school systems, because if we don't change the models, all we're doing is making the old education model faster and more efficient. What we need to do is take the best of what we know good education is, take the ideas of what we know good education are. We know what good education looks like. We know that education has to be relevant and engaging and personal. We know these things. And so what we need to do is ask ourselves, how do we bring these ideas to life? How do we use technology to bring these ideas to life? And if we start with that conversation, we'll create what the future of learning looks like.
Jamie Cassup is the global education evangelist for Google and is the keynote speaker at the 10th Annual Michigan Pre-College and Youth Outreach Conference. It's happening next Monday at the Michigan League on the campus of the University of Michigan. Jamie, thank you so much. It was great to have you as a part of The Next Idea.
Thank you very much for having me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Think about those moments when it seemed pretty much the whole nation was gathered around the TV set. The moon landing in 1969, a Super Bowl, a hit TV show, these days maybe Game of Thrones. My next guest believes it's that time in front of the TV that might be the secret weapon that helps future space travelers handle those ultra-long voyages. Jan Vandenbulk is a professor of media psychology at the University of Michigan. Welcome. Great to have you here.
Great to be here.
So we know one day a manned spacecraft is going to blast off for deep space exploration, and those are going to be the first humans ever to deal with not seeing the Earth.
Right.
And years of travel with not a lot to do until you get to your destination. What do we know about what that might do to behavior and thoughts?
I think up until now, any space mission has involved a lot of work. But when we reach out to something like Mars, it's going to be a lot of waiting. And it's not just waiting. There won't be any point of reference. You know, day and night won't make a difference. Mondays and Wednesdays won't make a difference. So that's what made me think, okay, is there something in our psychology that helps us distinguish between morning and noon and between Sundays and Thursdays? And that's how I started thinking, yeah, the media used to do that. They don't do it so much anymore because now we have DVD boxes and streaming video. But before, noon was a certain radio show that came on. And the evening, you know, you weren't supposed to, at least when I grew up, you weren't supposed to watch television until after a certain show came on. And so those little things told us what time of day and even what day of the week or what time of the year it was.
So it gives a sense of structure.
Structure, exactly.
But there are those TV moments when it seems, I remember setting the alarm to get up for the royal wedding. Things that pull us together.
Yes. So that's a weird phenomenon because, like, if you study something like audiences, media audiences, or the audience of this show, it's all individuals at home listening to the radio, watching television. They're not in the same room together, and it still creates a bond. And a bond comes from experiencing something big at the same time. Again, something that's lost now that we have streaming video and that you can watch it in the morning and I can watch it 2 years from now. But there used to be a time that if you wanted to see something or hear something, you had to be there together with everybody else.
I almost think that when I reference Game of Thrones, because I'm a huge fan and it's like an incredibly popular show, which they release globally because of the spoiler alerts. Like, you had better watch that episode on Sunday because you can bet on Monday everybody's going to be screaming about the Red Wedding. So we still kind of have that experience.
Yes, certainly. And it still has that effect on us. And I think that's why we feel so bad about spoilers. Or another weird phenomenon is, it doesn't apply to everyone, but there's a lot of people, if you record a sports program, you know, you're probably not going to watch it because it's not live. You're not there while it's happening. Well, you weren't going to be there anyway because you were going to watch it from home. But it does something to us.
Or you're my husband who records Manchester United, has it, and then, God forbid, he sees anything that lets him know. He hides from the internet. He will not listen to sport. He does not want to hear the score, and it ruins it. So he can watch it as if it was brand new. But he has to go to great lengths.
Well, and that's one of the fascinating things about the media, because sometimes when you study media, people think, well, you know, media are trivial. So, you know, studying it must be trivial. Now, but I do maybe trivial. But the media aren't trivial because it's such a large part of our lives. Look at all the trouble we have staying away from Facebook at night or not answering any emails. You know, there's so many ways in which they're part of our lives that we need to be aware of it.
So how would this, do you see, play out in, a flight to Mars?
There's a couple of peculiar aspects about media use in general that I think are illustrated by this example. One is heritage maintenance. You know, if you're from, say, Korea, and you're in a team with mainly Americans and Russians, part of you is going to want a connection with where you're from. That's what immigrants have always done. You know, they're interested in their home media because they want to keep that connection to their culture. At the same time, every immigrant has always looked for stuff that connects him or her to the new culture. So finding stuff that's communal will be another thing. I think the best example is probably many families. There was a time when we only had one TV set. And so we gathered in front of the TV set, and that was part of family life. Then, one of my professors said, then we invented central heating, and all of a sudden, we didn't have to be together anymore. But anyway, at some point, everybody had a TV set in his own or her own bedroom, and that sort of tore families somewhat apart.
Splintered.
But you'll still see that for some things, they will still come together and watch something together. Even though a lot of us feel that that's passive behavior, it's still doing something to us. It's creating a kind of bond by being able to watch something together and maybe joke about an actor or comment about something that's happening. It's a very simple way of creating a tiny community. There's not much cause for conflict with that kind of stuff. And you don't need to move. I mean, you can do it when you're scooped up in a little tin can.
I hear you saying, if you stream networks, let the crew watch Big Bang Theory all together. So we're talking about recreating something they know at home and also still having that context then.
Right, and of an older era, in a sense, because sometimes when you read about the psychology of space travel, they'll say, well, you know, they'll be bored, so send plenty of DVDs and books along. I think that's not enough, because the media can do much more than that. If you recreate that old way of watching television, Tuesday becomes the day that the next episode is going to be available. If it's something we watch together, that's going to be our day to watch the next episode of whatever it is. Not because we have it on a DVD and you've already seen it and I'm going to binge watch it tomorrow. So the old way of interacting with the media, I think, adds something to at least that situation.
So your advice would be to NASA, what would it be?
Well, make sure, I mean, all the guys up there and all the girls up there are going to be really good with computers, so they'd be hacking the system if you're not careful. But make sure they have that access to media that helps structure the day.
So stream the broadcast and cable networks, stream radio.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. And maybe even sort of reduce what the technological possibilities of today are. For instance, make it more difficult to record something or to watch it with some kind of delay. So now I'm forced to acknowledge that it's Thursday, and it's Thursday, 5 o'clock on Earth, at least the place we come from. And that's what anchors us. I'll give you another example. The media have always played a large role in defining seasons. It's the Christmas season. You see that because television is telling you all the time. Adverts are telling you. Movies are telling you. So that's telling us another year has passed. Another thing that you will have trouble with when you're isolated somewhere, whether it's on the North Pole or on a space mission. That's these old little things. Like today, you can watch a Christmas movie whenever you like, of course. But there was a time when the whole culture, the media culture, was telling us what time of day it was, what day of the week it was.
And the payoff, I'm sure, once the crew comes home, would be they haven't been disconnected from Earth for all these months or years.
A big effect of the media is telling us, you know, in a very indirect way, but it's telling us about fashion, about changes in language. I studied in England for a while. You can tell that the British language is evolving as a result of watching so much American stuff on television. You know, those kinds of changes, which are implicit. Nobody's telling you, okay, from now on, we're not saying bloke anymore. We're saying guy like the Americans do. Nobody's telling you that. But you get a sense of that by being exposed to media. So that kind of connection to Earth would remain that way. The other example is prisoners. It's one of the reasons why some prisoners like the media. It keeps them, you know, fashion changes, cars look different, the way people talk to each other looks different. Look at an old movie about the Romans. People have sideburns, not because the Romans had sideburns, but because actors in those days had sideburns. And those little signals is what we get from the media.
Interesting stuff. Jan Vandenbulk is a professor of media psychology at the University of Michigan with the secret weapon for deep space travel. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Still to come after the break, we'll meet a prisoner whose life was turned upside down by suicide. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. People convicted of murder as juveniles in Michigan have a chance to get out of prison because of that U.S. Supreme Court decision that said the law that required a mandatory life sentence for them with no chance at parole was cruel and unusual punishment. This prompted Michigan courts to begin resentencing some of its so-called juvenile lifers. With the second largest number in the nation, there are hundreds of cases to review. A few of these juvenile lifers have been released, but most of the remaining prisoners are awaiting their court date, knowing they could just be sentenced to die in prison again. Morgan Springer from Interlochen Public Radio has the story of one of these men.
Jose Burgos was 16 years old when he shot and killed Omar Khaji. It was the early 90s in southwest Detroit. It was the result of a bogus drug deal.
The whole plan was, you know, we're going to get this bag and we're going to make it look like, you know, from the outside looking in, it looks like there's, you know, 10 pounds of marijuana in this bag.
Jose and three other teens stuffed a bag with rags, hoping the twin Khaji brothers would hand over $17,000 without inspecting the bag. Jose and his people drove to the meetup spot. Jose put a gun in the bag of fake marijuana. Then he went into the twins' car.
And I got in the back seat. And as soon as I got in the back seat, the driver,
that was Omar Khaji,
had turned around and reached back and grabbed the bag that I had put right next to me.
Jose says he quickly told Omar, hold on, let me show you the marijuana first.
It was at that moment that I realized, what could I just get myself into? I don't even know what to do here.
Jose says he had never fired a gun before, but he saw Omar moving around, and though he couldn't see what he was doing, he thought he might be reaching for a gun.
From then on, it was just like, everything happened just like so fast. And that's when I reached in, I put my weapon out, I held it up. It was like adrenaline had taken over me, and that's when I fired the first shot.
Jose shot both the twins, grabbed their money, and ran to the getaway car. In the car, he took out the wad of cash.
There was a $20 bill on top of the stack. There was a $20 bill in the bottom of the stack.
But in between those two 20s was nothing but paper. In an attempt to dupe each other with paper money and rags, Omar Khaji was dead, his twin Ayman Khaji was paralyzed, and Jose was sentenced to die in prison.
Do you know when that was taken?
This one.
In her apartment in southwest Detroit, Jose's sister is looking at old family photographs.
That's my mom and him. That was a very old picture. Polaroid.
Jose's sister's name is Maricela Burgos, but no one calls her that.
I say like this, this is my thing. Who's calling me by my government name?
Instead, she goes by Prieta.
Prieta, that means dark. That's been my name since I was a child.
Now she's a single mother living in a second floor apartment with her four kids. Next to the house is a vacant lot where her landlord plants vegetables. Next to that is a collapsed house. In the front is a freeway. And she works at a grocery store nearby. Jose and his siblings came to the U.S. mainland from Puerto Rico when Jose was around 5 years old. Their grandmother raised them in southwest Detroit. They didn't know their dad, but their mother lived nearby with her boyfriend and was a big part of their lives.
Lourdes Maria Martinez.
That was their mom's name.
My mom was like the one that brought everyone together.
She was like the life of the party. She was very energetic.
After my mom passed away, everything changed.
She passed away in 1988. Jose was 13, Prieta 11. They say their mom and her boyfriend had always gotten along well, but then the boyfriend accused their mom of cheating on him and he hit her for the first time. Their mom came to their grandparents' house, and when no one was looking, she swallowed most of their grandfather's heart medication. They rushed her to the hospital almost immediately, but 3 days later she died, and it was ruled a suicide.
And, it crushed me, like, what about us? Where do we stand? You know, we're your kids, we love you.
At the hospital, the doctor took them to see their mom.
She had tubes coming out of her from everywhere, and she was just laying there. And everybody was just surrounding her, the gurney. And one by one, they were reaching over and they were kissing her on the forehead. And so when I came up, I stretched myself up, I kissed her on the forehead, and that was the last time I seen her there.
And after that, it was just all hell for all of us.
I can look back now, and when I take an honest inventory of my life, I can understand and recognize that this is where, like, things just started going bad.
That fall, 13-year-old Jose entered junior high and almost immediately started skipping school, smoking marijuana, drinking, and hanging out with the gang, the Latin Counts. The grandmother tried to stop him and make him go to school, but he wouldn't listen. 4 years later, at 17, Jose sat in court awaiting his sentence for shooting the Kaji brothers. He says he remembers it vividly, like the moment the Kaji's mother made her statement.
That's when she held up the picture. It was a picture of her with her two sons, and they were by her grave. And
Jose says it was the grave of the twins' father. The Kajis had immigrated to the U.S. after their father's death, and the Kaji mother told the court she brought her children to this country for a better life, and Jose had taken that away from them.
The mother's statement really has always stayed with me, you know. It's something that I've carried all of these years.
When it stays as it stays with you, what do you think about it?
You know, it's almost like my life and their life, it mirrors one another. You know, when I think about the families, you know, you got these two different families come from two different countries. They come here looking for a better life. And the one common thing that one of the main common things that we have with one another is the fact that, you know, we each lost a parent. And here we are, we end up somehow, you know, meeting up with one another. We both have these intentions in our minds, you know, in the deal. And it just, you know, that's just something that's always stayed with me. It's like, you know, how does something like that happen, you know?
When Justice Clarice Job sentenced Jose to life without parole, that was the mandatory requirement for all juveniles convicted of first-degree murder. Justice Jobs took issue with that at Jose's sentencing when she said, quote, "I find the limitations of this statute to be totally unfair to everyone concerned. However, I have to live with them and deal with them, so looking at all of it, I don't think I have a choice," end quote. But this is exactly what changed after the U.S. Supreme Court ruling 5 years ago. Because the court said the mandatory sentence Justice Jobs had to give was cruel and unusual punishment, judges can now choose anywhere from 25 years to life when sentencing these juveniles. Now they're able to choose a sentence based on that specific juvenile in front of them, looking at things like their upbringing and the circumstances of the crime. And for people like Jose, who already got mandatory life and will be resentenced, the court will also consider their behavior in prison, asking, does Jose fit the legal description, irreparably corrupt? In other words, is he irredeemable and does he pose a threat to society? Or has he been rehabilitated and does he deserve a second chance? These days, Jose is incarcerated at a correctional facility east of Flint. He's 42 years old, and he's been in prison for 26 years. He's a mentor for kids in trouble with the law, and he's a prisoner observation aide. That's someone who helps monitor prisoners who are suicidal.
We have a seat. We sit right in front of the cell. They give us a document to make sure that we document every 15 minutes exactly what the prisoner's doing. If the prisoner's laying in bed, you have to write down the prisoner's laying in bed. If the prisoner's talking to the prisoner observation aide, you have to write that down.
Jose says some suicidal prisoners don't want to talk, and so he'll sit there and observe and make sure they don't hurt themselves. But other prisoners will talk.
You know, if they tell me they have parents or any siblings, I explain to them, you know, they love you, and there's a better way, you know, to deal with whatever it is you're dealing with. You know, life is beautiful, and, you know, it's going to be okay. You know, no matter what it is you're going through now, you're going to have hard times in life, but it's going to be okay.
This is Jose's life coming full circle.
Every time I'm watching one of these kids, I always think about my mom, and because I think about, you know, what could drive a person to want to hurt themselves. You know, I never knew what exactly drove my mother to do what she did and how and what took her to that dark place where she felt that this is the only way out of the situation.
Jose's file is thick with certificates of achievement, his GED, classes, work, mentorships, and in the past 20 years of his incarceration, he's had very few infractions. But Wayne County prosecutors do not think Jose is rehabilitated. They did not want to comment on Jose's case in an interview, but in the motion they filed last year, they said, quote, "Defendant's crime in the current case was not the result of unfortunate yet transient immaturity, but rather evinced irreparable corruption that requires a life without parole sentence," end quote. Prieta doesn't think irreparable corruption describes her brother.
He wouldn't have tried to get in, you know, into this mentor thing and doing good things in there. He would have chose the wrong path if he was really that bad of a person, if he was such an animal. My brother made a bad choice, the wrong choice, and he's paid for it.
The prosecutor doesn't decide Jose's new sentence. A judge or jury will do that. But this recommendation does not help Jose's chances of getting out. Of Michigan's more than 350 juvenile lifers, prosecutors say 60% are irredeemable and should stay in prison for life without parole. That's according to MLive. This has surprised some, because the U.S. Supreme Court said this should only happen in the rarest circumstances, where the juvenile is considered irreparably corrupt. But these prosecutors in Michigan are saying over 60% in the state, including Jose, fit that description. This position is in step with the state's attorney general, who fought against resentencing, saying it would unnecessarily re-traumatize the victims' families. It's hard to know where the Kaji family stands now. They did not respond to multiple requests for an interview. But Eamon Kaji, who remains paralyzed from the neck down, is quoted in a Detroit Free Press article. He said during the getaway driver's trial over 20 years ago, quote, "I'm a Christian, but I'll never forgive," end quote.
I would like to say to the family that I am truly, truly, truly sorry for what happened that night. I had no right to be there. I had no right to have a weapon. I had no right to shoot. You know, nobody gave me no right to take a life. And that is something that I live with on a daily basis. It's something that I think about all the time.
You know, it's maybe a complicated and a basic question at the same time, but do you think that you deserve a second chance, that you deserve to get out of prison?
I think I do. I know without a shadow of a doubt that I am not the person I used to be. I carry myself now, and I live a life now where, you know, I don't define myself for what happened that night. I did have to be held responsible, accountable for what took place that night. But to say that I'm deserving of a life without parole sentence, of never being able to just know what life is outside of prison, I don't feel that I deserve that type of sentence.
For people, you know, some people look at it and say, you know, a life for a life. Why do you think it's fair for you to get out when one of the Kajis was killed and another one is paralyzed?
I guess I wouldn't compare it to it being fair. I'm not sure if that's how I would describe it. It is difficult to say, well, you know, I want my freedom, when in fact, you're correct, there's a person who lost a life. You know, I don't forget that. I don't want nobody to ever think that the victims get lost in our pursuit for freedom. I've had so many different conversations with other juvenile lifers, and we do not forget that on the other side of this is also a victim. So there's, you know, there's a balance there. There's a balance there where, you know, we do want to be free. You know, I want to be free. I want to be able to go out there and live my life. But there is a life that was tied to that, and there's no separating the two. The only thing I can do is go out there and be the best man that I can possibly be.
Jose says he believes a second chance is an opportunity for juvenile lifers to make a difference in communities they already took so much from. It's also an opportunity for him to do better by his family, particularly his grandmother.
She always tells me that she has a dream that, you know, one day she'll get up and, you know, there'll be a knocking at the door and it'll be me, you know. So I do the best that I can to see to it that happens, you know. That's another thing that you know, my grandmother, you know, I want to get out and make her proud.
Do you feel like you disappointed her?
I hope not. I mean, I know she wanted more for me. But I know that's, you know, another thing that drives me, just to become something that she can be proud of. Yep. Sorry about that.
There's this tricky dance with hope and fear right now for Jose and his family. The legal system is moving slowly. Jose's still waiting for his resentencing court date to be scheduled, and he knows full well when that date comes, he might leave court with the same sentence he arrived with, life without the possibility of parole. For Stateside, I'm Morgan Springer.
That story is part of Interlochen Public Radio's series Irredeemable about Michigan juvenile lifers. You can listen to more stories from this series by going to irredeemable.org. Next week, we'll hear from another juvenile lifer who got his second chance and is trying to make the most of it. He's enrolled in college classes and says he's had a long, difficult, and necessary conversation with the victim's family.
Throughout the conversation, she wanted to know what happened. And I explained to her what happened. And she wanted to better understand what was going on. What kind of family was I raised in? And I explained to her those things. And after having those conversations, she wanted to know about who I am now. And I was able to tell her who I am now. And not even 20 minutes into the conversation, she just said, I forgive you. And you're talking about one of the most greatest feelings in the world. That was the most greatest feeling in the world, to be forgiven by your victim's daughter and your victim's mother. I mean, that's better than a release from prison.
That's next week here on Stateside. Just a reminder, an invitation for you to join the Stateside team and me this evening. We're doing a live show in East Lansing. We'll have a conversation with longtime Lansing Mayor Virge Bonero. We'll feature a Lansing area artisan, and we'll discover why the mid-Michigan region is a landing spot for refugees from around the world. You can catch that and much more by joining us tonight at the Kellogg Center on the Michigan State University campus. The show begins at 7 p.m. Hope to see you there. All the details are at michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.